The joke among accountants is that when you see something that has limited assurance, it basically means they are tying together an Excel file and saying, oh yeah, look, this ties together, as opposed to what you would do in a reasonable assurance audit, where you're really going through that audit trail and making sure that you can pull those inputs yourself.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. Change is coming for corporate America. In the last year, we all thought it was in the form of climate disclosures, but the SEC still hasn't issued the proposals that they came out with in 2022, despite telling us that it would likely be fall of 2023. And in fact, they've walked back one of the most controversial proposals. How these rules are written will dictate the type of information investors get, and in turn, shape the way businesses respond to climate change and other ESG issues like human capital management. Here to walk us through where things currently stand is Colleen Honigsberg. Colleen Honigsberg is a professor at Stanford Law School, where her research is focused on corporate and securities law and has been widely published in leading law journals and mainstream media. Not only is Colleen a law professor with expertise in the regulatory environment, carbon accounting, and human capital, but she also holds a PhD in business and is a CPA. Kind of impressive. Colleen, we're so excited to have you here today. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me. These are some of my favorite topics. I'm excited to chat.
Oh, good. Well, we're excited to speak with you as well. So I was hoping you could start us out by discussing your own background, including your accounting background, and how you came to specialize in business law and how your accounting background influenced that.
Sure. So I actually started off, I was originally pre-med at undergrad, and then I realized that I hated the sight of blood. And so my fourth year, I needed to find something that would just give me a job and pay me so that I could pay off debt. And so I sort of fell into accounting. And so my final year of school, I took a bunch of accounting classes and actually found that I just loved it. It's like, it's systematic, it's organized, the structure just kind of appeals to me. And so after that, I went into one of the big four. I worked at PwC. I was there for a couple of years and got my CPA. And then after that, I actually transitioned into litigation consulting. And when I was at litigation consulting, a lot of our experts were actually law professors. And so we worked closely with the law firms. We also worked very closely with the law professors and other experts that we were supporting. And I noticed how happy the experts were. And so I was like, these people have the best job. I mean, we had one guy who refused to schedule a meeting before 11 a.m. And this was somehow like acceptable. And I was like, what profession allows you this type of flexibility? And so I asked some of our experts, like, how do I become a law professor? And they said, go back to school, get a JD, get a PhD, and then go on the academic market. So that was what I did.
Wow. Okay. So why a PhD though?
So I did it originally really because I wanted a job and I thought that it would help me place in the academic market, which it does. But in retrospect, I'm also just really glad I did it because it gives you a lot of skills. And if your career is research, I think it's important to be, as skilled and sort of nuanced as you can and hopefully good at what you devote your life to. So for me, in retrospect, I'm really glad we did it. I did it just because I think it really does improve my research, which is where I spend most of my time and, what I love about my job.
Right. Okay. So now you have every letter imaginable after your name. But so speaking of your research, when I was reviewing the different publications, different pieces you've published recently, I noticed that it seems that you've taken an interest in what looks like a focus on ESG or regulation kind of in that area. What got you interested in that?
So an accounting PhD, I would say, is very broad. People sometimes hear, I did a PhD in accounting, or as my mom tells people, PhD in bookkeeping. People think you're really studying GAAP, and you're not. I know GAAP because I was a CPA and I teach accounting, but that's not actually what my research is. For an accounting PhD, I would say the coursework tends to be pretty similar to econ or finance. But the questions we ask are different, and the questions often center on how do you disclose relevant information to key shareholders and other stakeholders in a cost-efficient manner. And so for that, you know, a lot of it is traditionally financial information, but, you know, today a lot of that information is falls under what we might deem ESG or, you know, non-financial metrics. There are sort of key performance indicators. So I would say a lot of the accounting research now focuses not just on disclosure of financial information, but disclosure of other things that, you know, investors or other stakeholders think is very relevant to them.
Yeah. And so that shift has been really where like all the action has been lately. So I was hoping we could talk about two of those components. So maybe start with climate disclosures and then move on to human capital. So, I mean, we know like on a general level why we should care about the climate, right? I always compare it to, I don't know if you are a Game of Thrones watcher, but I always compare it to that. Like everyone in Westeros was like fighting about who's going to sit on the Iron Throne. Meanwhile, the White Walkers are coming over the wall. So it's like, we're all here down on Earth. We're arguing about foreign policy and civil rights and stuff. But meanwhile, the Earth is like dying in the background. So I feel like we should all care about it, right? So we know on this general level why we care about climate change, but why should we care about it as business leaders and the lawyers who advise them?
So I would say there are two key reasons. First would be because your investors and probably your employees are pushing you to care about it. And so if something is really important to your investors and often really important to your employees, especially if you're here in Silicon Valley, then you kind of have to care about it or at least like give lip service to it. So that would be just the first like kind of pragmatic view. And especially when I do director's education, that's often what I hear. And that like, look, we're getting a bunch of questions about this. We have to make these stakeholders happy. So we kind of have to care and, you know, make some progress. The second reason though, and I think the reason that, you know, that is supposed to be sort of motivating the SEC would be more of like, we need to think about the long-term implications of climate on our businesses. And as we move into, you know, more pressure to have a net zero environment, how is that going to affect my business model? And so do we need to adapt now and adjust? How long is this going to take? What is the transition going to look like? How am I going to pay for it? And all of these types of questions that, you know, if we think you have a business model that may not be sustainable in the long term, well, you probably want to start adjusting now. And so I think that is the kind of broader underlying reason why people and businesses should care.
Okay, so the SEC in March of 2022 had their first foray into ESG. And this was a wide-ranging menu of different ESG disclosures. It drew, you know, thousands and thousands of public comments. So why do you think that they decided to enter this climate change debate fray in the face of so much opposition, especially from, you know, powerful corporates?
So I think probably two key forces. First, institutional investors have been asking for it. And, you know, we can probe into the incentives of those institutional investors and like why they're asking for it, but they're definitely asking for it. And they were asking the SEC to make mandatory disclosures in this area. So if you have a bunch of key large investors that hold a very significant portion of US public companies asking you to do something, you have to consider it. And in academia, we think a lot about the incentives of those investors. And on one hand, you think of like, you know, we've got their sort of optimistic view. And this would be the view that, you know, some of these institutional investors, the Vanguards and Fidelities and such, they are worried about the long-term, you know, viability of these companies. And they want to know, well, if you, again, like our the answer to the last question, you have a business model that is reliant on, you know, a lot of unsustainable technologies, shall we say, how are you going to adapt? You know, if you are Exxon, well, your business probably isn't going to be the same in 20 years. So how are you going about that transition? We want to know now. You need to provide us with that information so that we can evaluate if you are doing a good job and, you know, if we want to invest in your company. So that would be, I think, the kind of ideal version. There are definitely some academics who would argue, though, that this push by the institutional investors has more to do with a marketing effort by those investors.
Is this the greenwashing argument?
Yeah, it's very similar to that. It's basically the idea that you have now Gen Z and millennials who are finally starting to get money, some because they're actually making money, some because they're inheriting money, but now they have funds to invest. And if you think about the incentives of the big institutional investors, well, they're getting paid mostly from assets under management. And so they want to increase their assets under management. And so if I want millennial or Gen Z money, well, I have to appeal to those potential, you know, investors. And if those potential investors think I really care about climate change, this institutional investor is actually making a push in this area. I want them to manage my money. And so that's the more cynical view, that basically they are just trying to increase their assets under management and appeal to a younger generation that cares a lot about these issues. So there's definitely divergent views on like why the institutional investors are making this push, but I don't think there's any question that they are. And so from the SEC's perspective, well, you've got, you know, a bunch of funds asking, we want this information, and their job is to provide investors with information. So they're just doing their job. So I think that's the main push. I think, again, the other argument, and not to say that I endorse this, because the other argument that you do hear is like, you have commissioners and they have their own incentives. And perhaps their incentives are to get another government job or to just in general help the world. And so perhaps they're acting in their own incentives as opposed to, you know, what the overall agency should be doing, and that you have that sort of agency problem of like the conflict of interest.
Okay. So the truth is somewhere in there. So I wondered if you could walk us through, there were, it seemed to be a couple of categories specifically of climate disclosures. And there's one that was pretty controversial that we'll spend most of our time focusing on, and that was the greenhouse gas emissions. So yeah, could you just walk us through those categories that they proposed?
Sure. So we have scope one, scope two, and scope three emissions. And scope one emissions are like direct emissions that are, you know, owned or controlled by the company.
Could you just back up for a second, Colleen, and tell our listeners, what is a greenhouse gas emission?
Okay. So these are GHGs. They're, you know, gases in the Earth's atmosphere. They trap heat. And so I'm not an environmentalist, but I'll be the primary cause of climate change.
Got it. Okay.
So because they are, you know, so closely related to climate change, you have, you know, a lot of investors are saying, we want information on what level of like greenhouse gases you're emitting. And if you're offsetting some of those through other types of transactions. And so that disclosure has sort of formed in along three different, what we would call scopes, where those scopes are, you could think of as like sort of varying levels of responsibility and control from that company. So the first one would be scope one. And these are direct emissions that are owned or controlled by a company. So for example, if you are burning oil in your fleet of vehicles, well, that is something that is very directly under your control. And so that would be scope one. And that's the most kind of straightforward category. Our next category would be scope two. And scope two, these are emissions that a company causes indirectly and that it comes from energy it purchases. So for example, if you heat your building, well, you're not actually like burning, you know, whatever and creating that, but you're using it. And so that would fall into scope two, like, you know, the electricity that you're using to power your own buildings, even though you're not directly burning it, but still you're kind of indirectly responsible. So that one, I think we would say, you know, you have a little bit less control over it and little, perhaps maybe less responsibility than scope one, but it's still pretty closely related to the business. Now, scope three is like where it kind of goes haywire for some people. So scope three are emissions that are not produced by the company itself, that are not the result of activities that are owned by or controlled by them, but emissions that it would be indirectly responsible for because it's up or down its sort of supply chain. So for example, if you think of Apple, well, the emissions from Foxconn would be scope three. The emissions that, you know, people use from generating their iPhones or whatever, that would be scope three.
How could you ever account for scope three emissions?
Yeah, this is the problem. It gets really hazy and it gets really difficult. Like for a long time, and how you account also even for offsets within them. I know in the past, I don't think they do it anymore, but in the past, I remember looking at Alphabet and they had an offset of like reduced emissions from giving people good directions under Google Maps. And so like, how do you kind of incorporate that? It becomes really messy. It becomes subjective. And there's not a really obvious, clear model of how you would do it. And so that's probably the main concern. The other concern, though, too, is just bear in mind, if we're trying to like add up total worldwide emissions, this approach is not going to get us there because Scope 3 is going to double count the emissions. Because when Foxconn reports, they have their own emissions. When Apple reports, they're reporting their emissions plus Foxconn. And so you are double counting all these different sources. And so if we were to look at then this total sum, you know, using this approach, it would be far greater or should be far greater than, you know, what we're actually seeing in real life. And so that's another big criticism here.
Right. So, yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even thought of that. So in recent weeks, the SEC has actually decided to pull back, or they've suggested at least that they're going to pull back from that Scope 3 requirement. What's odd to me about that is that, I mean, I get it because like you're saying, it's super hard to account for. But what's odd is it's also, my understanding is that Scope 3 is a huge part of the climate problem. So the Scope 3 emissions account for what? Like I read something like 70% of a company's carbon footprint. So it's, I feel like pulling back from this is almost ignoring the biggest part of the problem.
I mean, I would fully agree with that. So, you know, I feel bad for the SEC in the sense that like, this was really controversial. It's really hard to capture. And it's hard to identify a correct number there. It's, you know, really hard to get good assurance. At the same time, like, as you just said, if you don't disclose it, you're missing the bulk of the emissions.
Yeah. So what's the role of the ISSB? I wonder if you talk to us for a second about that institution. What's their role here now that it seems like the US might pull back from some of these requirements?
Sure. So as a little background, so in the US, you know, we have generally accepted accounting principles, which are, you are sort of standard accounting requirements, and they are promulgated through the, like, an entity we call FASB, which is overseen by FAF, the Financial Accounting Foundation. In the EU, the comparable organization would be, or entity is IFRS. And so ISSB is basically the sustainability requirement that is associated with their accounting standard setter. So in the US, we don't have this type of, you know, sustainability accounting standard setter the way that they do there. But they set up the ISSB back in 2021 because they were like, there are going to be a bunch of sustainability related things that people are going to care about. And we have to figure out how to disclose them. So the ISSB, their first two standards are both about climate, and they start as of January, go into effect as of January 1st, 2024, which means the first reporting period will be in 2025. So companies that follow and have adopted those ISSB standards are actually going to have to disclose something very similar to, you know, the Scope 1, Scope 2, Scope 3 that we were just discussing.
So the ISSB standards do include a Scope 3.
Unless they make some changes going forward, but they did originally, yeah.
Do we have any companies in the US that are trying to adhere to those standards, or is it strictly for the EU?
Well, multinationals, because they are, you know, yes, US companies, but they're reporting under the EU. So they will be reporting under the ISSB standards. It's very common that companies already report Scope 3 emissions. It's just the question of like the reliability of that number that they're reporting.
Okay. So speaking of reliability, something else the SEC proposed was assurance requirements. And so this is auditing, this is climate audits. And my question for you is, can we trust when a company has performed a climate audit that they've been thorough about it?
I would definitely say no. So we joke that sort of climate auditing is like the wild, wild west of accounting, or wild, wild west of auditing, I should say. So when you think about a financial audit, there are, especially for public companies, we're usually talking about four, you know, big four auditors. And we are talking about a, quote, reasonable assurance, which means, you know, we are giving reasonable assurance that these numbers are in compliance with GAAP. When we are talking about a climate, then or assurance level, where you usually, if you read those, they are providing, quote, limited assurance, which means they are providing truly limited assurance that those numbers are accurate. So a couple things when we're dealing with the climate audit space. One, you have way, way more variation in auditor than you do in the financial reporting space. So a lot of the climate auditing firms are, you know, maybe an engineer. Some have a financial aspect, you know, the big four have been trying to move into this area, but they tend to be much more expensive than the traditional climate audits. So, you know, that is going to be an additional burden. You look at like the people who are doing climate audits, and there's just so much more variation in their backgrounds, in their professional lives, in, quote, the auditing standards that they purport to use. And that, you know, when you're doing like financial audit, you're using auditing standards from the for a public company, you're using auditing standards from the PCAOB. When you look at like what auditing standards they're using in the climate space, they're all over the place. Sometimes they don't even say what auditing standards they're actually using. Sometimes they say they're using standards, but then you look at their background and they're not like, they don't seem to have any certification or background in those standards. So you're not sure how they're, you know, how well they're applying them. So it's a totally different space. And the joke among accountants is that when you see something that has limited assurance, it basically means they are tying together an Excel file and saying, oh yeah, look, this ties together, as opposed to what you would do in a reasonable assurance audit, where you're really going through that audit trail and making sure that you can pull those inputs yourself. So again, the joke is like, you're looking at limited assurance. Perhaps this is even worse than no audit, because it suggests that the company doesn't have the data trails in place for the auditor to really trace everything and be able to come to their own, you know, independent assessment.
Wow, that's really disheartening. How do you see that industry evolving? Because I mean, in accounting, it's just like there's all these types of standards and institutions and programs that you must follow without question. And now I feel like we've entered a time in history where this is going to be the next industry that has to come up with some real metrics. Do you see it evolving, or is it just like it's kind of wishy-washy and that's how it is?
I think it will have to evolve if there is a mandated assurance requirement, especially if they do mandate reasonable assurance. With that said, I think the software, it needs to evolve, and that companies need to have internal software that tracks this information so that you can actually perform the type of audit that I think sometimes investors think is already being performed.
I see. Okay. So you've written, Colleen, a lot about human capital. And to be honest, when I read the headlines about the SEC disclosures, right now people are talking about climate, but I find the human capital aspect of it so interesting. So I was hoping you could talk to our listeners a little bit about human capital, what it is, and why investors are asking for more transparency now into it.
Sure. So human capital, when you think of, if you go ask a CEO, what is your most important asset? Chances are they're going to say their employees. Yet employees are not anywhere in financial statements, because employees are not assets because they can leave the firm. So it's not like you have a line on the balance sheet that's like human capital. You know, there are some instances in a small portion of labor will actually be capitalized. I can get into that, but I don't think most people care. But it's a very small portion, and you don't really even figure out how much of that is being capitalized. The vast majority of human capital is missing from the financials.
When you say human capital, Colleen, when you say capitalizing the human capital of a firm, you're not talking about accounting for like their salaries or their bonuses. You're talking about literally trying to capture their value in some way.
So ideally, what you would want would be to capture and disclose their value. What I do mean there is that you do, in some rare instances, actually capitalize their salaries. But that's such a small portion that I won't get into it now unless people really care. But it does occur in some small instances. But for the most part, you know, human capital is just omitted from financial statements. And if you think of like how a company can invest, well, I can invest in my employees, I can invest in research and development, I can invest through acquisition, I can invest by purchasing physical property. And the accounting effects are going to be different for those different types of investment. And I would say the accounting effects for investment in human capital are the worst, because very, very, very little, if any, is going to be capitalized. And it's not even disclosed. So it's not even like an investor can look and see, you know, okay, their cost of goods sold went up, and that's because they started paying their employees more. It could be their cost of goods sold just went up because like they had a high utility bill. And that's bad. Whereas if your cost of goods sold went up because you're actually paying your employees more, well, there's evidence that that helps with retention going forward. And so it does actually provide you with a future benefit. So in my mind, employees are a really, really, really important asset that are just omitted from financial statements. And if we look to using like European data under IFRS, where you do get a little bit more information on employees than you do in the US, you can see that capital expenditures as a percentage of sales have remained roughly constant at about 10% over the past 20 years. Whereas if we're looking at investment in labor, that has roughly doubled over the past 20 years. And it's gone from, you know, around, it was about 25%, gone to about 40%. So it's a huge, huge portion of your operating budget that is simply not disclosed. And so in my mind, this is not about ESG. This is just about understanding a company's financial statements, and that you really need to understand what their operating costs are, especially for companies that are reporting a net loss, which about half now of publicly traded companies are actually negative net loss companies. And so if you want to project out when those companies are going to be profitable, what sort of investments they're making, you need to know, are they investing in labor? At what point are they going to be able to scale? And so I need a much better sense of all of their operating costs than I get right now from the income statement. So in my mind, human capital is actually just like a traditional account, should fit into the traditional accounting framework, and we should just provide more information on labor, on turnover, on labor costs, on the components of labor costs. And I don't really see it necessarily as like kind of a social issue. I just see it as like, this is something that is key to understanding the profitability of a company that we don't provide.
I think, yeah, like if we're here for like investor disclosure and investor information and having full transparency, and this massive piece of the puzzle is left out, that's kind of odd. You're not saying like, oh, it's about employee wellness. You're just saying like, this is important.
I care about employee wellness, but that's not my sort of push here. I think sometimes I describe this to people as, let's say you're building a large manufacturing plant in a particular location and you churn through employees. That's just your business model. Well, at a certain point, you know, you're going to churn through all of the local labor. And when you have churned through all of the local labor and you don't have that resource anymore, how are you going to staff that plant? And the plant can't move because it is a physical location. And so what are you going to do? And then we would think about, you know, allocation of other assets in this way. So I just think that we should think about human capital in this way as well.
Wow. Okay. So you petitioned the SEC to require this type of disclosure. Tell us about that.
Sure. So it was with a group of other, some other law professors, also some other accounting professors. And we basically just outlined, look, the accounting rules are different depending on how you were investing in your business. And we should at least give investors the information they need to understand, are you investing in your workforce? And so we asked for a couple new pieces of information. So we, I think ideally would like to have your number of employees. For many companies also, you really need the number of their independent contractors as well, because they have more independent contractors than they do technically employees. So we would like to have that type of information, some information on salary and like how much are you paying them in total and what are the components of that compensation. And then also what we think would be really helpful would be to see where that is in the financial statements, like how much of it is in cost of goods sold. So for example, when cost of goods sold goes up, well, is that because of labor costs? And actually FASB is moving in that direction, which is fantastic. Then we would also requested that in the management discussion and analysis, you have some information where the management actually discuss what is our strategy for labor, how much are we investing in labor, and you know, just give us a little bit more information on how we can evaluate this asset. The other component that I think is really relevant would be turnover. Because if you're looking at a company and they have very, very high turnover, and especially if it's a company that's very reliant on its employees, like they have a lot of engineers, well, that's clearly relevant and it would be something that investors want to know.
So is it customary for the SEC to respond to a petition like this? Not really, right?
Not terribly.
Yeah.
No. We also requested it through, I'm on the SEC's Investor Advisory Committee, and we have a petition. We filed a recommendation there too that's pretty similar to our petition. So we should get some kind of response to that. And the SEC does have human capital on their agenda for 2024. I'm not optimistic that it actually goes through unless we have another Democratic administration, because they don't like to do rules too far into the term to where they could be overturned easily in the next term. And I just don't think there's time for them to actually issue the proposal and finalize it, you know, before we hit that deadline.
But ultimately, on the long view, don't you agree that we're going in this direction, that eventually we will require disclosures on this topic?
I do. I also think that human capital is not nearly as controversial politically as climate. So when we're talking about climate, you're talking very sharp political divides. Human capital, I mean, I testified in Congress on human capital, and I had three Republicans say they would work with me. And they were literally like, this is not ESG, this is just accounting. And I was like, yes, that's how I see it too. So I think it's much less controversial. Also, even if you care, think about the social aspects, we've seen, you know, Josh Hawley and Elizabeth Warren come together on some of the issues related to labor force, like having a higher minimum wage for employees, some, you know, union protections. So I don't think this fits as neatly into our political divide as climate does.
Yeah. And just, I agree that it's potentially good for the social agenda folks, and obviously important for just people who care about accounting in general. I mean, to connect the dots between the success of a business and their employees' contribution to that success and their investment in their workforce, I think is important for investors and for employees themselves.
Right, exactly.
Well, Colleen, this was fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today. I love hearing your perspective on climate, hearing about your petition, and I didn't realize that you had testified on this exact topic. I guess I should have known that, but I'm not surprised at all because you are really becoming quite the authority in this space.
Well, thank you for having me. And of course, if there are any questions, let me know.
Yes, will do. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.